Welcome to the State of the Markets podcast. I'm Paul Rodriguez of thinktrading.com.
I'm Tim Price of pricevaluepartners.com.
And our very special guest is Tracy Shuchart from Hill Tower Resource Advisors.
Tracy Shuchart, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. Tables have turned. I had you on my podcast, so nice to be on yours.
All's fair in love and war.
So, Tracy, you're the CEO and founder of Hill Tower Resource Advisors. What does your role involve?
Basically, I'm the CEO, and we do analysis for the natural resource industry, and we have a retail level as well as institutional level.
Right. And so do you cover literally all resources?
We focus mainly on energy and metals markets.
Right. And so what do you see at the moment as the main kind of trend?
Well, I think, you know, if we're looking at the energy industry, it's definitely higher for longer. And, you know, we can see oil creeping up now. And I think that's going to be a problem for the Fed because it's going to add to inflationary pressures. But, you know, if we look at this market, you know, people were talking about how we're tanking at $70. But if you look at historical norms, we're still well above historical norms. And these are adding to inflationary pressures across the board.
Well, we've seen very recently that the dollar has had a slight move higher, but that seems to be a very slight move in what was kind of a major downward trend. But we've seen a tick up in oil. The big movers have really been gold. Silver seems to have woken up from a slumber, and people have cottoned on to that being a bit underperforming and kind of trying to buy the gold trade at a cheaper price, if you want to think of it that way. But other metals aren't really moving as well. Platinum and palladium seem to be underperforming. Do you have a reason for why that might be happening and whether they're going to join the party?
Well, you know, I think that we have platinum and palladium have been rather range bound. I prefer platinum over palladium just because of its uses in industry. Over palladium's kind of stuck in that catalytic converter. That's what we can use it for. And platinum is used in a lot of other transition metals. We've seen a lot of pressure across all of the energy transition metals. I think as sort of we're finding out now that, you know, wind and solar, as I have been stating for quite a long time now, are just not able to, the projects that they want to do are not feasible with higher interest rates. In a NERP-ZERP world, absolutely, you could build all of these projects that you want. But, you know, we're running into problems now that we're not living in that world anymore. And, you know, we've seen a lot of problems, particularly in wind, a lot of cancellations of wind farms in the U.S. from European countries. Companies, and that's kind of putting pressure across all of the metals in that kind of transition sector.
That's really interesting. So you're saying that there is this kind of awakening of that this green, so-called green energy isn't as green as people thought, and it's not going to work.
Well, absolutely. Where, you know, again, it's not only funding, but people are realizing that you can't use energy or wind and solar as baseload power. You need something else, such as natural gas or coal or oil. And certainly, obviously, natural gas has gotten a lot of recognition lately. It's a lot cleaner than coal. And we've seen a lot of companies sort of invest in this area now, particularly after the Russian invasion of Ukraine, and Europe basically stopped piping in cheap Russian natural gas.
Right, but the main sort of headlines that we see, especially in the UK, I'm guessing it's going to be the same stateside, that that the way forward is green energy, and green energy means, you know, wind farms, solar panels, and that type of energy. Whereas that's all been pushed forward on an agenda of what was virtually free money. So the economics seemed to work, but now interest rates have normalized, as it were, or maybe are still perhaps a bit lower than they should be. It's now not making any sense, and people are waking up to the fact that it doesn't make economic sense to follow that path. And companies kind of vote with their dollars, and even if they're getting subsidies, they're still pulling those plans.
Absolutely. And that's the big irony of it, is they're still pulling plans, even as we've seen, particularly in the United States with the IRA Act, and you have Europe has sort of their version of the IRA Act, where they're giving companies a lot of subsidies, but companies are losing money hand over fist and divesting of a lot of current projects. And I think you also have to realize is that as much as you want to push solar and wind, it's not a baseload power, and I keep saying that. And we don't have the battery technology available to even store that kind of energy. And so, you know, I think that it all sounded nice and great in 2016 with Paris Accord, and this is what we're going to do. But, you know, 7 years later, here we are, and we're nowhere near where initial projections were.
Do you see the pushback against alternative green energies as part of a wider pushback against an agenda that some of us would find difficult to accept, peddled by people like the World Economic Forum and similar sort of supranational, unelected, unaccountable bodies, things like DEI and ESG, you know, all these sort of acronym type concepts?
Absolutely. I mean, we've seen, you know, if we've seen a major pushback against ESG, we've seen big companies like Vanguard drop out of the ESG Alliance. We've had the Insurance ESG Alliance basically completely disbanded. We're seeing, you know, on earnings calls, even, you know, where you saw everybody was mentioning ESG 2 years ago, nobody's really mentioning ESG anymore. And so we're seeing a lot of pushback, not only from companies, but large funds as well.
So that really sort of goes back to Paul's point of just a few minutes ago. Do we think that a lot of these things were basically a kind of whimsical indulgence in a zero interest rate environment, but they can't actually survive? I'm trying to think of I think it was a Prussian military strategist that said no battle plan survives contact with the enemy. And none of this stuff actually works in an environment of basically normalized interest rates.
Absolutely.
That was an unreality that's unlikely to recur. It was like a fantasy environment, a kind of Potemkin market.
Well, it is. And, you know, I mean, you have to understand that, you know, the West can push this agenda. But if you look at emerging markets, they barely have any share of, you know, global emissions. And we're trying to force something on them that they're just not even there yet.
But how do you account for that? Because, I mean, China, I mean, not to sound contentious, but China's the biggest polluter in a traditional sense in the world. And yet no lobby groups seem to be trying to get China to change its act. We're also to be focused on ourselves. And the UK, by comparison, is a tiny emitter of so-called dirty energy byproducts relative to China. So how on earth did we get into this state of affairs, do you think?
I think it's group mania think, right? To be honest with you, you know, we had a bunch of unelected bureaucrats get together and decide on this arbitrary 5 degrees Celsius, we need to lower the temperature, we need to do all of these things. And it was, you know, it's a bunch of think tank people that have no real world experience on energy and energy flows and how energy actually works.
But to put your feet to the fire, to use a phrase that we were using, Paul and I were using back in 2020, is this a function of cock-up or conspiracy? Or a combination of the two?
I think a combination of the two. I mean, kind of if you look at Germany, right, in the middle of an energy crisis, they shut down all their nuclear plants. and started buying wood pellets.
That reminds me of a sequence in Blazing Saddles where the new sheriff holds a gun to his own throat and says, "Either release me, I'm gonna shoot." And one of his colleagues says, "Come on, boys, he may be serious." And it's like, yes.
You know, it
makes any sense
at all. And so, you know, and I've been saying, am I like, is this just, you know, is this malicious intent? Or is just this just utter stupidity? And, you know, I think it's probably a combination.
I guess when you're dealing with bureaucrats, it's difficult to tell the difference.
Correct. That is correct.
It is difficult to work out whether it's stupidity or corruption or whatever, but it is very worrying. I mean, you see it with economic policy and you see it with policies in general. But it's usually, we had Doomberg on quite a while ago, actually, and they made a really good point that it's actually the poorest people who end up suffering the most when energy prices rise. And, you know, it's almost as though these plans are put in without thought to what it might do to those people.
Or to make life even worse for those people.
And in countries where they are really impoverished, if you want people to care about the planet, having cheaper energy makes them care more. I mean, if they've got nothing, you know, to gain by kind of having a family and living a cleaner life, as it were, why would they bother with other elements of protecting the planet if they haven't got access to cheap energy? I think it was a point that Jordan Peterson was making, and I think it was a really interesting one, a very good one, that if you bring people out of poverty with cheaper energy, then they will preserve the planet in a much more responsible way.
Well, absolutely, and that's it. If you want, you know, third world nations or southern hemisphere nations, if you want to call them, to flourish, you need cheap energy, and you can't, you know, it's all fine and well for the West to say, for Europe and the US and North America to say, oh, just, you know, build some wind farms and some solar. It's totally fine. You're skipping steps in kind of the evolutionary energy usage sphere, right? So going from something like dirty, dirty coal to wind just doesn't work. You're skipping a whole bunch of the evolutionary steps that you need to take to get to that point. And to be honest, we're not even to that point. So,
yeah.
You know, I think that it's kind of very egotistical of the West to sort of place their ideology on these countries that are, you know, just trying to get to even close to where we're at.
So the energy companies are not allowed, from what I understand, the power that gets delivered by these companies, they're not allowed to store it. And it's either they're not allowed to or they're unable to. And I'm not sure which one it is. Do you know?
It's kind of a combination of both. We really don't have the battery storage technology at this point to be able to store energy in the amount from green transition energy in the amount that we need to keep our grids going. And that's why you're seeing everywhere that, you know, suddenly even the UK just said, we need to build more gas plants right now. So we don't have blackouts. I
mean, shouldn't we really be building better storage systems? I mean, there is one in, I know there's one in Wales where they kind of pump water to the top of this sort of, not a mountain, but it's a very tall hill, and they use sort of overnight energy to do that, and then they get that energy back the next day by allowing the water to come back down again. So there are solutions. It's just we need to look at storage solutions.
Absolutely, 100%. Nobody's focused on that part in the way that we need to be. So that technology is just not here yet. So we're trying to put the horse before the cart, so to speak.
And that kind of begs the question about what people do about electric cars, and as more electric cars go on the road. Interestingly, we were discussing this on a pod a while back, and I was giving some anecdotal evidence about a a van driver who I knew, who's a workman, and he was having terrible problems because he was saying in the winter his van he couldn't put the heating on because he couldn't get the range, and in the summer he couldn't put the air conditioning on because he couldn't get the range. He'd have to wait after a hard day's work in a queue for, you know, an extra half hour to get to a charging point to then charge up, you know, for a few hours, and then go overnight to then the next day to worry about whether he's got the range. And he ended up getting rid of it. And, you know, most people understood that, and most people do understand that there are problems, range anxiety with electricity. But some people just thought, oh, that I was kind of anti-electric car. But I'm not at all. I'm all for technology. It's just that, you know, practically, it only works in certain situations. On top of that, I was speaking to a driver who had an electric car, and he was saying it's virtually impossible for him to charge it because he lives in a flat and a road that he can't park in London. When he bought the car, he was paying something like 18 to 20 pence per unit of electricity. It's now 85 pence per unit of electricity, so it doesn't make sense to use it anymore. And he has the same range anxiety problems. Can't pick people up from the airport because he's worried that he's going to run out of fuel and all that sort of stuff. So it's again, it's like, and then I hear just the other day that the Which magazine, which is a consumer magazine in the UK, it did a report about electric cars and how the ranges are overstated by the manufacturers. And you know, it's what most people knew. So it seems to be that the reality is starting to hit about how this is going to work and how they're going to roll it out. And it doesn't seem like we can get off oil and gas and natural energy does not seem to be replaceable at this point.
Well, it's not. And that's the reality of the situation. You know, if you have an electric vehicle, that's all fine and dandy. Say if you live in an urban area that has a lot of charging infrastructure, provided that you have one in your apartment or condo, and you have to go very short distances, and that's fine for that. But if you were talking about long haul delivery, if you live in an environment that is cold, particularly Canada has a lot of problems with electric vehicles. The United States, for example, is huge. People drive a lot here and drive very far distances, and there's just not the infrastructure, the charging infrastructure available. And it's not convenient. You know, it takes you 5 minutes to fuel up your car. Who wants to sit and wait, you know, an hour to charge their car? People aren't used to that. If you want a technology to go forward, you need to make it be easier on people's lives, not harder on their lives.
Yeah, absolutely. And at least they could be cheaper. But apparently they build into the cost of you not having to actually have your car serviced, because a petrol engine is a very complex system with lots of parts that needs to be changed, worn out, et cetera, et cetera. Whereas an electric car, you just have brakes and lights, and that's kind of it, really. There's nothing else that you might need to change. And obviously,
well, the battery's
at the end of its life.
Expensive.
Yeah, yeah. But you don't need to do that every 3,000 miles or 6,000 miles, which you'd have to do in a normal car. And anyone who's been to a dealer to have their car serviced will know that you can come out with some pretty hefty bills just from a basic service. So gone.
This reminds me of something I encountered in the limited time I spend in advertising, which is the best way to kill off a bad product is to market it really well. And it seems to me that what the world has done, or what the West has done, or what the green lobby has done, is they've aggressively over-marketed something which isn't yet fit for purpose. And in the process, because they've done it too soon, they've basically killed off the product. And right. the similar example here, and I don't know whether you have this, it's in the States, but here we have this. You know, it's a problem that shouldn't be a problem because it should never have been created. Is the government's trying to get people to buy heat pumps, which are basically unaffordably expensive, inefficient. They don't work. Nobody wants them. But apart from that, they're great. And it's like, well, why bother when we have these perfectly acceptable workman-like things called gas boilers, and they're far cheaper, and everybody loves them. We've been using them for decades. So what's happened here is that a lobby for its own motives has tried to aggressively foist this stuff on a rightly skeptical public, and it's backfired horribly.
Well, absolutely. I mean, think about anybody. When you try to push something on somebody, you know, the more you try to push something on them, the more they kind of back off from it, right?
I mean, and also where the rubber hits the road is when people are charged through the nose to do something that they don't really, they're skeptical about anyway. So the idea that, you know, the only way heat pumps, I think, work at the moment here in the UK is that the government's providing all kinds of subsidies for people to use them. Right. And nobody fundamentally wants them because they don't work.
Well, you know, that's the same thing with all of this green technology right now. There's so many subsidies attached to these projects. It's unbelievable. But the public doesn't necessarily want them. I personally don't know anybody. I know one person that has an EV and that likes it. One.
Yeah. I mean, per se, you know, having an electric car, I for short journeys in London, I wouldn't mind it. I don't have a problem with that at all. But practically, I mean, if I just think about where I live and where Tim lives, I know that if we both have problems charging the car, if you haven't got a driveway, you can't charge your car. If you have a place outside your house where you can run a cable and somebody's parking in that place, you can't charge it. It's just as simple as that. So unless you've got like a driveway and a charge unit, which you know that could be set up if you've got a driveway, no problem. So it's very specific. And if you look at how many cars are parked on the street, would you be able to charge all those cars that are parked on the street easily?
Absolutely not.
Exactly. Absolutely not.
The electric grids couldn't even handle it if we went 50% EVs. Right? We have Asian grids all over Europe, all over the US, all over Canada. You know, if you wanted to reach half of the goals that you wanted, you still couldn't. And nobody wants to pay for the upgrades.
But I think you've inadvertently, you know, put your finger on the problem, which is they don't want us driving. That's the issue.
Yes.
They want to get people off the road. I mean, I think it would be, I don't know what you call them in the States, but I think it would be fantastic if Paul and I could drive around in bumper cars to get to work. These are the, you know, but the thing is, that would be impractically involve electrifying, you know, the entire street network between Hampstead and, in my case, Holborn and Hatton Garden. And it's just unworkable. It would be great fun, but it would be unworkable.
Well, and I think what people also overlook is the extraneous costs with these EVs. I don't know, you know, the cost just to insure your car is 10 times higher for an EV, just for auto insurance, than it is for a regular gas vehicle.
Wow.
And
by default,
they're raising, yes, because they're prone to fires and they're prone to a lot of damage that other ICE vehicles aren't. And when damage happens to an electric vehicle, it's 10 times more expensive.
And the fire brigade won't go near them because they're too scared of being eviscerated.
Yeah. And then by default, what we are seeing here now is if you have an EV and you charge it in your garage, your homeowner's insurance is going to go up.
No.
Because IRS.
Wow.
Right?
No, that's incredible. I didn't know that. But it makes perfect sense because lithium batteries are essentially dangerous if they're not handled correctly.
Well, yeah. I mean, we have seen, you know, we just had an entire car carrier vessel explode, essentially, that was carrying a bunch of EVs because one of the batteries caught on fire. And so, you know, it's also very expensive. It adds even more cost because now it's very expensive to insure one of those carriers for, you know, shipping across. So there's all these extra added costs on to these vehicles that people, I don't really think, have stopped and thought about.
We had a whole car park here ignite because I think it was an EV caught fire.
Well, that's interesting.
Dozens of cars that went up.
Well, I heard that it was reported as a diesel, but I heard that it was a hybrid. So I'm not really sure what that was. But it is an important point. And one of our previous guests, and you know, someone that Tim and I know, Shane McAvoy, he put me onto the problems. He showed me some videos of, you know, Tesla's on fire and the fire authorities standing back going, we're not dealing with this. And
they let them burn. That's yeah. The thing. They're too hard to put out. And so if it catches on fire, literally the fire departments, they kind of control the area, but they just let them burn because there's no real good way to kind of put those out. And so that's also another insurance risk. So if your battery catches on fire, your car is totaled. That's it.
Mm. At this rate, Twitter might end up being worth more than Tesla.
Yeah, it's a funny thing about Teslas because they are cool looking cars, but I don't know. I mean, they're extremely heavy as well, really heavy. Because I was listening to the podcast that Elon Musk was doing with Joe Rogan, and he was saying that battery technology is solved, and the range isn't the problem. And I'm like, and then he went into detail about how the problem with car production is actually just the manufacturing process. But I don't know, for such a smart guy, I thought, no, the batteries are still a problem. And there is new technology coming out. There's something called a lithium sulfur battery that apparently has got 5 to 10 times the power of a lithium ion battery. So that would be a huge amount. And
Samsung also is looking at solid state batteries. So, you know, there's other battery technology certainly in the works right now, but, you know, it's just not commercially viable right now.
So for the sort of investor and for the company going forward, if they were to say to them, right, what should we be looking at in early 2024? Where should we be investing our money, do you think? What would be your sort of go-to markets to consider?
Hard assets. You know, I think that we saw summer of 2022, we had hard assets explode, metal prices, energy prices. You know, we did really well after, you know, that kind of that 2020 fallout. So 2020 to 2022 is great for hard assets. I still think we're in a commodity bull cycle, but of like all cycles, you have ups and downs in between. And I think 2024 is going to, people are going to be looking at hard assets again. And we are already seeing clues of that in, you know, precious metals and in the energy markets right now.
Well, some people might say that gold is at an all-time high, so it's expensive and they shouldn't buy it. What would you say to that?
That's ridiculous. To me, it's an insurance policy, right? And so I think you should always have some of your portfolio, at least, particularly if you are older, allocated to gold, just as a safety. I mean, even if the price of gold goes down from here, which is fine, it's still, you know, a safety net, right? And so I'd recommend definitely, you know, at least some of your portfolio, the kind of weighting, I think, depends on your age and your risk group. Obviously, someone younger probably won't have as much allocated to gold as, you know, somebody, you know, 40s, 50s, 60s, probably want to have more because it's an insurance policy. And you know what? If you never have to cash in on that insurance policy, that's fine. That's great. But you never know.
Wouldn't you have said to younger people that it's that buying it and kind of forgetting about it and keeping it as an insurance policy would be great? Because over the very long term, Tim will all have all the stats on this. It's been an amazing investment.
Well, absolutely it is. And, you know, and I think not only, you know, paper gold, but, you know, physical gold as well.
Well, I guess it comes down to context, doesn't it? Because the best gold research I know is from the guys at Incrementum in Liechtenstein. And they put out their gold report every summer, I think. And they regularly put not just the dollar price performance, but the performance of gold in every currency. And basically, whichever currency you measure gold in, going back to 2000, it's delivered probably 8, 9, 10%, and in some cases higher. It's rivaled equity returns even over the last 20 years. It's been extraordinarily successful. But the thing is, that clearly wouldn't have been the case if you were talking about, say, the period from 1980 through to 2000. So context is everything. But the reality is, as I would suggest, is that we're living through a time when the contextual importance of gold can't be overemphasized, because the contextual importance of owning hard assets can't be emphasized, because it's not so much about what gold's worth in dollar terms. It's we're now living through what's the dollar worth, if anything.
Right. Absolutely. And, you know, we've, you know, printed our way into oblivion, right? And not even close to actually, I mean, we could call it normalizing rates, but, you know, every central bank's balance sheet is exploding. I don't care if they have some rolling off, but let's be honest. I mean, still kind of vertical if you look at any central bank balance sheet. And so what has that done to currency? Well, any currency, it's devalued it.
Yeah. For me, the question is not what is the value of the dollar? It's why did they unpeg it from gold in the first place? And
therein lies the big problem.
Exactly. And it's so if they say it doesn't need to be pegged to gold, then why was it pegged to gold in the first place? And then why have we since had such a problem with inflation? And not official inflation figures, just the inflation that we all know exists, that appears in things like house prices and how much we spend on anything day to day. You know, it's a common joke where, you know, the person says, you know, back in my day, I used to be able to you know, go out for a night out and still have change for the bus home, you know, from a pound or £5 or whatever it was. But actually, you know, that was the case. You used to be able to do that. We have a problem with fiat currency constantly being devalued, and it's because of the way it's been managed. And it's insidious, because the people who know most about that are the older people who've seen it happen over time.
But I'll answer your question or your suggestion, Paul, which is the reason this has happened is because money is too important to be left to either governments or central banks. Unfortunately, at the moment, we're stuck with both of them.
Do you think that, that's a really good point. Sorry,
it's all
Tracy.
You know, it's merely your faith in the Federal Reserve, right? What is your faith in the Federal Reserve? Because that's your faith in the dollar, right?
But in terms of gold and silver, do you think would you suggest that buying silver now is a good catch-up play? Or would you say that you prefer gold because it's showing strength? As a technical analyst, you always go with what's strong. But also, I look for breakouts of things that are kind of sleeping and then suddenly playing catch-up to the trend. And it looks like silver wants to play catch-up.
Oh, I absolutely love silver. Absolutely love silver. Actually, more than gold.
Oh, really? Okay.
To be honest with you. And so, absolutely. And you know, the reason that I do, let's go back to gold versus silver. Do I think silver is a good play? Yes. If you look at the gold-silver ratio right now, it's at the perfect spot. You really want to be buying silver, right? So, you know, when the ratio is high, that means silver is relatively cheaper than gold. And right now the ratio is 90 to 1. So, you know, to me, that sounds pretty good if I can buy 90 ounces of silver for the price of a single ounce of gold, for example. So I think that, you know, it's very undervalued at this time compared to gold. So I think it's a great time to be looking at silver. That said, why I do love silver even more than gold, believe it or not, is because not only is it a store of value as a precious metal, but it's an industrial metal as well. 45% of silver is used for industrial purposes. And so if we look at, you know, if we want these green goals, then, you know, you have to look at what kind of uses, what kind of silver is in these products. So you have silver in solar panels, a lot of silver in solar panels. You look at silver in automotive. Every electrical component needs silver. And these EVs are more and more electronically intense. than, say, an ICE vehicle. So you need a lot more silver per vehicle than you do for an ICE vehicle. And same with if you're looking at wind turbines. They also use a lot of silver because they have a lot of electrical components in them. So I think that's great. And then if we look at the kind of the demand supply issue, you know, we've had, you know, we had 2023, we had 140 million ounce deficit between 2021 and 2023. And, you know, that is literally more than the surpluses of the prior 11 years that we had.
So who's got the biggest supply of silver?
I'm thinking it's going to be Mexico, North America, Canada.
Right. Okay. And what about African countries and Australia?
Well, certainly Australia. So the top 10 countries are Argentina, US, Bolivia, Australia, Poland, Russia, Chile, Peru, China, and Mexico.
Right. Interesting. Interesting. And that's a really emphatic, you know, view of silver at a time when it does look like it's going to break out. And but for Tim, for money, silver's not as attractive for you, isn't it? Because of its industrial potential.
We're agnostic on the sort of the money side. So the reason we like silver as much as we do is exactly the same reasons that Tracy's alluded to. But I think the fact that it is an industrial metal as well is an extra hedge, because you can't have a functioning modern economy without a conductor like silver. I mean, she's mentioned cars, she mentioned automotive, she's mentioned
healthcare,
industrial applications, wind power. It's in phones. It's in everything that's part of the modern economy. So you can't have a functioning economy without silver. It's just impossible.
Yeah.
And I'd say that's a hedge. So it's poor man's gold, to the extent that it's so much cheaper on a dollar cost basis anyway, by weight or by mass. But it's the fact that it also is a hedge against, you know, let's hope that we can get ongoing economic growth into the future. What's not to like?
Exactly.
Whereas gold tends to be more of a sort of a hoarded commodity, whereas silver was actually partly used by the industrial sector.
So do you have any preference to numismatic coins at all, Tracy?
Owning physical gold and silver is never a bad idea, right? Regardless of what your investments are.
Right. Move on to sort of energy in general. There's this realization that obviously green energy might not cut it, and perhaps politicians are going to have to change their outlook. Do you think nuclear is something that they're going to be focusing on again, and could uranium be an area to invest in, or do you think it's going to be, you know, oil and gas for now and coal?
Yeah, no, I think we're in a 10-year bull market, just starting a 10-year bull market for uranium. We've already seen a, you know, kind of a change of attitude, you know, as we see that wind and solar are not working. We have seen nuclear sort of come back. Obviously, we've seen a huge run up in uranium prices right now. We're seeing a bit of a pullback right now. But what's really interesting is that we saw in the last COP meeting was the very first time they actually talked about nuclear. Nuclear had been largely ignored for all of these meetings. And you actually had 23 countries sign up to pledge to triple their nuclear capacity by 2050. Now, that's next to an impossibility, but it's a notable change in sentiment, which I think is very important, because mostly we've only seen nuclear in Asian countries. And now the West is starting, except for Germany, is kind of starting to realize that we're going to need nuclear if you want clean energy, and you can use it as a base load. And, you know, once they're built, they can last 80 to 100 years. And so, you know, cost-wise, you know, it works out much better than, say, you know, wind or solar, where these products have to be replaced on the regular consistently.
Yeah. Do you think U.S. interest rates are going to go down this year, or do you think they're going to stay stable?
I think they're going to stay stable. But I've been saying, you know, it was very strange because, you know, Powell, for all of 2023, And since he started, you know, raising rates in 2022, I said consistently, higher for longer, higher for longer, higher for longer. And it wasn't until that December meeting when he suddenly got very dovish and, you know, brought up this idea of lowering rates. And then the market went crazy, priced in 6 rate cuts for the year. I was like, this, some, you know, this doesn't really make sense. And obviously, and since then, you know, for the last 3 months, we've seen core CPI rise again. We've got, you know, PPI on the rise again. And so I think, you know, those are major headwinds for the Fed. I'm not really sure what the catalyst was for kind of that December move in how their verbiage.
Yeah, I wondered whether there was another shoe to drop in the banking sector. And there's been some pressure on certain banks. So I was trying to work out whether it was because inflation was going to be better than expected because they yanked up interest rates so quickly. I'm not saying they didn't need to move them up, but it's just the way they spent all this time wrong-footing people by saying that they're not going to raise them. And then suddenly just raising them at such a clip that it just caused massive problems. So I wondered whether that had to work its way through the system, and therefore they may have overshot and it, then rates go down a bit, as inevitably they're always playing catch up with interest rates. The economy is always ahead of them. I didn't know whether it be that or whether there's a bigger bank failure coming. And I'm wondering now, as we stand today, whether there is another bank failure coming, because the way Bitcoin's moved, the way gold's moved, the way the dollar hasn't gone down, that's kind of a bit of a strange situation that the dollar hasn't gone down to follow the way the broad equity risk on trades are going. It means there's a piece of the puzzle I'm certainly not seeing. And so I'm beginning to think that it might be that we need to see a bigger bank failure, then we get the lower, you know, excuse for interest rates. But actually the market loves that because it means that, you know, rates go down and that more upside for equities again.
Well, I think we're already starting to see a few cracks in regionals again.
Yeah.
I think that my conspiracy side of me says, I think they want failures in the regional banking system. I think they want consolidation as much as possible.
Is that so the bigger banks can pick them up at a song?
I think it's because
JP Morgan doesn't own everything yet.
If you eventually want to go to a CBDC, how much easier is it to control 5 banks than it is to control 4,500 banks?
Mm.
That's kind of my conspiracy theory.
Couldn't they force, I mean, I take your point, but couldn't they force them to, couldn't they regulate them into doing it and say, look, we'll just take away your license if you just don't do this? But I suppose it's easier just to buy them.
You know, and Yellen kind of gave some clues on that a couple of months ago when she said, I expect to see more consolidation in, you know, the regional banking sector. So she kind of let that slip. So I don't know. I think it's by design, personally.
Yeah.
Let's see what happens.
Great. Was there anything that we hadn't asked you about that you wanted to discuss?
No, I think we got to talk about all my favorite things.
Brilliant. Brilliant. Well, that means that we go to our media picks round, which, Tim, what... I daresn't ask, what have you got for us this week?
I'm going to make this especially interactive media picks round. So, Tracy, the ball is in your court now. So I can either go with sublime or ridiculous. Would you rather have sublime or ridiculous?
Oh, I kind of like ridiculous.
I'm so glad you said that. So ridiculous one is The Day Time Ended, which is a 1979, I suppose you could call it a film. It is... you know, comprised of, you know, visual images.
I mean, that's a ridiculous title for a start, isn't it?
It gets better. So the Day Time Ended. If you want a quick way of assessing whether a film is just truly beyond dreadful, you need to see how many titles it's had during its lifetime. The date I'm ended was originally called Earth's Final Fury.
Ah.
And then it was changed to Vortex.
Okay.
And then it became the date I'm ended.
Right.
Now, there is another one on a related topic, which is called Insect! Exclamation mark. Which is an Insect! Exclamation mark, which is actually a very thinly disguised version of Aliens on a much lower budget. For some reason in the States...
Like already.
Well, they're both classics of their own type, genre. Insect! Exclamation mark was originally... Well, actually, its release title in America is Blue Monkey, without an exclamation mark. And then you say, why is it called Blue Monkey? And it's loosely set in a hospital, and the reason it's called Blue Monkey is because there are four, like, tiny little kids that are, like, 7 or 8 years old, and they're being treated for various ailments in this hospital, and they're sort of going down and exploring in the tunnels underneath the hospital. And one of them says... I hope we find a blue monkey. And that's the sole reason they called the film Blue Monkey. It is beyond absurd.
Anyhow, how did you find these things, Tim?
Well, basically, I've got some free advice for anyone that, like me, is a connoisseur of rank awfulness online. And basically, go into somewhere like YouTube and do a search for something like classic horror or classic sci-fi. And then after a few minutes, you'll find there's a channel on there that has like thousands of free films on. So the YouTube, and I'm sure there are other platforms, but YouTube has become a suppository. I think I mean depository of all of this just classic, awful content that for those of us that really like, that cannot have enough cheese with their cheapo film choices, it's transcendently good. So The Daytime Ended very, very quickly. It stars... Jim Davis, who was Jock Ewing in Dallas, if anyone remembers the original TV series Dallas. That's about what it has. Basically, otherwise, by way of acting, the best acting is done by the horses in the cars, because it has a few horses and a nice pony.
But now I'm intrigued.
So basically, all you need to know is it's about a family. It got a house in the desert. UFOs are involved. A triple supernova is involved. It's UFOs. Then for some reason there is stop motion animation of dinosaurs.
Not Harryhausen style though.
Harryhausen style.
Oh, is it? But not quality.
Oh, it's not of that quality. No, obviously it's not. It can't be as good as a Harryhausen. And basically, so there's stop motion dinosaurs rampaging around, and then after that it makes less sense, if that's even possible. But anyway, it's The Daytime Ended. But if anyone wants a sort of follow up, because that's just not long enough for them, then try Insect! Exclamation mark / Blue Monkey. And if that doesn't tickle your comedy horror, comedy sci-fi, inadvertent comedy sci-fi, tickle your ivories, then I'll give everybody their money back.
Do you like literally burst out laughing while you're watching them? Because how else would you sit through it?
Some of them are preciously hilarious.
Brilliant. I think you could have a sideline as a reviewer for this sort of stuff and just create a Substack.
It would be too easy to do, because I'm minded to think of Spinal Tap and Spinal Tap, where they're talking. Do you know Spinal Tap, Tracy?
Yes, of course.
One of the funniest films ever made. And and the band are themselves looking at their own reviews, and they have one of their albums is called Shark Sandwich, and the review just says shit sandwich. They go, they can't say that, can they?
It's so brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant. Love it. Well,
follow that.
Yeah, that's a hard one to follow, Tracy. But what have you got for us?
Well, mine does not beat that at all. mine's a little bit more serious, but I have a book that I just read called The War Below, Lithium, Copper, and the Global Battle to Power Our Lives. Mm. It's a really fascinating book. It kind of explores the mining industry, but kind of in stories. And so it kind of explores kind of the brawl between big industry, conservationists, community groups, policymakers, governments, and things like that, but in a storied form. So it's not boring, right?
Brilliant.
Uh, I just think it's fascinating because it's, you know, the mining industry is a huge power play. It's very prevalent right now, obviously, with the green transition. And this book just came out a couple months ago, and it's by Ernest Shader, and it's fantastic. So I definitely recommend that. And it's not what you, it doesn't, it, it's not as dry as what it, the title sounds like.
Quick question for you, Tracy. Have mining companies been more attractively priced in your career than they are now?
No, I think they're totally undervalued right now. I love mining companies right this second.
Right.
I mean, I think I like mining companies right now. They're they've underperformed. They're hated. You know, same with energy companies.
But these are all bull arguments, though. To
be country.
Exactly. That's why I love them right now. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
I love anything that's hated, right? And you're going to need mines no matter what. You know, it's completely undervalued. PEs look great, you know, especially when looking at some of these tech companies like NVIDIA that are just ridiculously wildly overpriced, in my opinion. So I love mining companies right now. I love energy companies right now.
I thought it was very interesting that there was a headline in the Telegraph from on the journalist who said, why you need to buy NVIDIA. And I thought, wow, isn't that an interesting headline?
Because was there anything written in the article?
Well, I didn't read
space?
It.
I
thought you're not going to see that at the bottom. You're not going to see why you need to buy mining companies. So it's a classic contrary opinion trade. You could have got that a bit better, you know. So that's very interesting. And that's why things work this way, and that's why contrary opinion works this way, because it's always after the event that then the media starts to tell people why they should be doing something. It's not, and that's why when something's hated so much, it's resisting that hate, as it were, it actually means it's being accumulated, and it's being quietly accumulated for its next bull run. So you shouldn't really expect to read about it, and you shouldn't expect to hear about it from anywhere.
I hope the media doesn't catch on, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean they will eventually, but that'll probably be when it hits the top. So there we are. So very interesting. So for my media pick, it's unfortunately, it's not going to be a original one. It's just that I got around to watching Napoleon, and I could see why Tim and others really enjoyed it. It's a great film, an amazing piece of work, you know, cinematic experience. Like,
did you see it at the cinema or on TV?
No, I got it on Apple TV, but which I recognise was not the best way to watch it. I actually regret not watching it in the cinema, because hopefully they'll run it again and I'll be able to go and see it on the big screen. But it utterly fantastic. And I think there's going to be a longer version, because I think it was cut down. But just great performances all around. What you guys were saying about it, so I can only just, you know, really second it a little bit later. But yeah, a fantastic film. So Tracy, sorry that we've overrun just a little bit, but thank you so much for coming on the show. And before you go, could you just let us know where people can find you? I know you've got a Twitter handle and obviously your research company.
Yes, absolutely. So I'm at Shy Girl on Twitter, CHIGRL, stands for Chicago Girl, because I started the account when I was living in Chicago working at the Board of Trade. And my company is Hilltower Resource Advisors, and it's at hilltowerresourceadvisors.com. There's a lot of information on there as well. We've got a blog that's open to the public. You can get a lot of insights into the commodity sector. So I'll go take a look at it. And thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Do you do the Substack thing, or is it just...
I do have a Substack. It's called Renegade Resources.
Interesting. Good name. Fantastic. Well, Tracy, thank you once again. And, you know, we look forward to having you back.
All right. Thank you very much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Thanks, everybody. This podcast is for entertainment purposes only. Please do your own research or contact a professional advisor.